The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark. And in the week that secret documents are cascading out of the website WikiLeaks, we're going to ask whether governments can legitimately keep secrets from their people.
Do we accept that some things are better kept under wraps? Or is it true, as David Cameron once said when not talking about WikiLeaks, sunlight is the best disinfectant?
Well, one person who certainly doesn't think so is Jonathan Powell. Tony Blair's former chief of staff has followed his boss in writing recently that freedom of information was a big mistake. He joins us in the studio now.
We have him and we also have the journalist and freedom of information campaigner Heather Brooke. We'll discuss WikiLeaks but also the Lib Dems' continual wriggling on the issue of tuition fees.
On Sunday night, a group of newspapers, including The Guardian, published the first of what will be around a quarter of a million secret US embassy cables. Since then, we've had stories about how the Saudi king wants Iran bombed, about how the Bank of England's chief thinks that George Osborne is lightweight, and today, allegations about the conduct of Vladimir Putin's mafia government in Russia.
Downing Street condemned the leak as damaging to national security, and then Hillary Clinton went even further.
The United States strongly condemns the illegal disclosure of classified information. It puts people's lives in danger, threatens our national security, and undermines our efforts to work with other countries to solve shared problems. This administration is advancing a robust foreign policy that is focused on advancing America's national interests and leading the world in solving the most complex challenges of our time.
Heather, the public are interested, but what is the actual public interest of the WikiLeaks?
There's all sorts of public interest issues in the WikiLeaks cables, and it would be wrong to say that they're titillation. I mean, I don't think you could get a subject that would be more in the public interest. And even something like Prince Andrew, which was one of the pieces I wrote, you might say that's titillation, but really that's incredibly constitutionally important. Here you've got a member of the royal family who's meant to be our representative abroad, and he is seen to be trying to influence one of our government's corruption inquiries. So even things which might on the surface seem titillating, I think have really deep public interest in them.
But isn't part of the argument that The Guardian, dare I say, taking on my employers, is using to get on its high horse, is that the American government was sharing this stuff too widely? It was wildly irresponsible to let millions of soldiers have access to this kind of material. So isn't the solution, according to that, to have more control over information and not less, as people like yourself are proposing?
Well, there's a lot of questions packed into that one you've raised, because there's the point that it's not the responsibility of the media, I don't think, to think about once it gets information. I mean, it has to care about what it's going to put out. But really, if these are issues that are so in the national interest, then you would think that a national government would put some effort into keeping them secure. And it's not about how many people it was shared with. It was about the absolute lack of security that they had around the sharing of that information. And
so you do draw the lesson that in some cases you need more security as well as needing more openness in others.
Well, I mean, I think that there was two problems. One, there was an overclassification. So there's lots of information in that database which really should have been in the public domain. And if you look at some previous leaks, so I'm thinking of the collateral murder video as well. I mean, that was information which was clearly in the public domain. It had been the subject of a Freedom of Information request. The Pentagon had denied that that video even existed. And yet there it was on that database. Why wasn't that released? So there's the issue about overclassification, and then there's the issue that if it is actually legitimately in the national security, it needs to be kept secret, then they need to make sure that they actually know how to do computer security, which it seems that they don't.
Jonathan, they didn't know how to do computer security, did they?
No, it was a bizarre idea to put it on a huge intranet and then make it available to quite so many people and allow people to download it onto their personal CDs when they pretended they were listening to Lady Gaga. That does seem a bizarre way to handle it. But I think partly that's because quite a lot of these telegrams are actually rather run-of-the-mill. I mean, I think Heather's point about their classification is right. You'll find actually if you go through the Foreign Office telegrams, masses of telegrams are hopelessly over-classified.
You thought some of them were rather good, you said in your piece, didn't you? You'd have been proud of writing them as a young diplomat yourself.
Yeah, some of the assessment, like Bill Burns in particular in Moscow, some of the assessments were really very good, very well informed, and had a few good jokes in them as well, which is always nice.
So therefore, you're saying it was a shonky system, so you surely can applaud that it now will not be able to be a shonky system in future.
Well, I'm sure that they're going to, I'm sure they have closed down this intranet, and I'm sure they'll think about it more carefully. I mean, what they were doing, presumably when they set it up, was trying to make sure there weren't this silo approach so that you could share information across different bits of the system. The trouble with the American system is it's so big. They have a real information problem. They have a massive information overload. It's interesting, when your presidents deal with issues, most of the information hasn't got to the president because the system is just so big, there's so much of it, it can't work its way through. Our system is much smaller and has much less information, but at least it can get its briefing act together.
Slight sideways twist in a sense, but you've written in your new book on Machiavelli, like your former boss Tony Blair did in his recent book as well, that the great mistake that the Blair government made was freedom of information. And what we're seeing here is kind of freedom of information writ large, in a way. Could you just expand on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, firstly, I didn't say it was the great mistake the Blair government made. We made a huge number of mistakes, and I wouldn't even put this in the top 10, but it was a mistake, and I'll explain why. I don't think you could really say that WikiLeaks are actually a Freedom of Information Act. It's not. This wasn't a Freedom of Information request from Heather. Then they released 250,000 telegrams. They were stolen by a young private and then stuck out on a website. It's a rather different sort of thing. The problem with Freedom of Information, which we espoused in opposition and actually legislated for, is it worked out not quite what we'd hoped it would be. The idea was to have something that the public could access to. They could get their own records. They could see how the workings of government work. They could put their own requests in. What it became instead was a game with journalists, where journalists would try and get the Christmas card list or the guest list for dinners at Chequers.
MPs' expenses,
which I would praise Heather for doing. Now, what I would say, referring back to what Heather said earlier, is it seems to me there is clearly, I mean, I hated leaks when I was in government. It made life incredibly difficult when you're trying to do something and a secret letter is released and the person you're talking to, like George Bush, then gets very upset about it. It makes it hard to manage. But there clearly is a public interest in releasing certain things like that. I don't have any quarrel with that at all. I do have a bit of a quarrel with the idea of industrial scale leaking. If you just take 250,000 telegrams, most of which have no public interest, I don't have any interest at all, let alone public interest, and put those out there, it's really stretching the argument of public interest, in my view.
But you're saying, okay, 250,000 documents is one thing, but you are saying that you think there should be more restrictions on freedom of information as we have it in order to protect.
I think there's simply a practical problem that what happens in countries that have freedom of information laws, people find ways of working around them because that's the only way they can work the system. If you look at Germany, the Kanzleramt, the central organ of the government in Germany, any document it produces in final has to be released to the Bundestag. As a result, there are no final documents in the Kanzleramt. They all stay in draft. They never actually get to the final stage, so they're not released. If you look at the White House is so worried about freedom of information, so worried about their hard disks being subpoenaed, all the sensitive government is done on yellow post-it notes, and that's not a good way to do government.
But that's surely, I mean, that's the problem, in that freedom of information isn't strong enough. It's not enforced. And I would say that what I wrote in my piece in The Guardian is that the leaks are not the problem. They're a response to a problem, and the response is over secrecy. And if you look at how freedom of information is done in America, it's vastly more open than Britain. I mean, I would say Britain is just decades behind in its ability to share information with the public.
But do you think they really write down properly where decisions are made, or do you think things get
written on? Britain has been completely closed up government as far as the inner workings of Parliament for a long time, and they haven't written down things. You can go. How I first learned about parliamentary transparency was to watch a Yes Minister from the 1980s, and the whole point in that episode, they're talking about how they don't write anything down, and this is when they didn't have a Freedom of Information Act. So the fact that you have this act doesn't make people write down more or less. In fact, I would say, in a culture of transparency and where you feel that you must be accountable directly to the public, you do write things down because you want to be able to justify why you've made decisions.
Jonathan, did you want to come in on that?
Well, I was just saying, I was surprised when I thought you were going to say of government, but actually you said of Parliament. And Parliament, of course, prides itself on being open. Now, clearly it was secret about its expenses and the various things that then got revealed. But you actually think the workings of Parliament in terms of the debates and the political shenanigans of Parliament is too secret?
Well, my bigger problem is, you're right, with the government. But certainly my practical experience has been more involved with Parliament. And I don't feel that even now it's as open as it could be. And there's still a kind of rowing away from commitments they made about publishing expenses and receipts.
I mean, I think the there is an argument actually on that. I would agree with Heather that there is a problem, particularly it's a sort of British social problem, really, or cultural problem, rather than a political problem, that as a society and as a political system we are too closed, and it would be good if we did open up more. My argument would be, in practical terms, what the Freedom of Information Act tends to do is make people freeze up. They find ways of getting around it rather than cooperating with it, which is why you had such a long battle.
But that is just the initial reaction, because people haven't, I don't think we've really come to a mature democracy here where people in power are willing to accept that the public are an equal partner in government.
I think they still think
they want to manage the public, and they feel they still put them in a childlike position where they don't understand that they have a right to that is in fact their information.
Just very quickly, the events of the last 2 weeks, so we had the government put all of the spending decisions over 25 grand.
That's great, and I think that was probably one of the best things I've seen since I've lived in Britain, actually, was just that to me was something that a mature democracy would do, where they don't try and manage the release in any way. They just say, right, we're going to put all this information out there. And then if a journalist wants to do the heavy work of going through and analyzing it and finding a story, then that's up to the journalist. But I think that's the mistake that this government has always made, is that in its total obsession with trying to manipulate the media and control public opinion, in fact, it creates more energy around leaks.
Do you mean British government, or do you mean this current one?
I'm talking about the British government, sort of over the decades.
But don't you accept? I mean, okay, we have freedom of information, and maybe over the years, gradually, we'll change the culture, and stuff will be released, and people won't get their knickers in a twist in the same way anymore. That's all great, but when it comes to matters of war and peace, and in particular, the highest aim of government avoiding war by having negotiations, sometimes you might need secret and rather messy discussions and, dare I say it, grubby deals that you might not want to come out.
Yeah, certainly that's true. And I agree there's a case for confidentiality, just as with journalists. You know, we often need to have, keep our sources confidential. But for me, the reason I keep sources confidential is a really limited reason. It's if the person's going to be harmed in some way by being named, or, you know, in some way they're going to be compromised. But It's not the norm that I would agree to anonymize a source, which I might say is not the culture in British journalism, where they like to anonymize sources for no good reason at all.
Well, they wouldn't talk to us again. There's a rather ominous sentence at the end of the report today on the Russian telegrams in the WikiLeaks story in The Guardian, where the head of the SVR says that he's going to be going through all the telegrams and giving a report to the leadership. And having had a look at the telegrams when I came in here on Sunday night, there are some of them from Russia, which include names, which will be extremely dangerous for the sources of those stories. I mean, there's one about Sechin, for example, and where his money comes from, lists the people who told the Americans this. If that comes out without the names redacted, and even with the names redacted, it'd be possible to guess, those people are going to be in very, very serious threat.
But, I mean, that's why these cables are on a slow release. I mean, some people say, well, isn't it against the spirit of transparency that they're not all dumped out? Well, no, they're not dumped out because having read through them, we can all see where the dangers would lie. And like as you've just mentioned, that's why, you know, particularly these Russian cables, they have really been sort of read through very finely, and they've gone through the lawyers and everything else.
Jonathan, you've given some of the arguments about why we need to be a bit cautious about total transparency in terms of sources and good government and so on. But isn't it the case that once all the red faces have kind of faded from this, the people who are going to get caught are not the Americans, who, whatever we might not like about their policy, have a reasonably open political culture, but places like Saudi Arabia, where people say one thing in public and something entirely different in private? And doesn't that really make the point that openness is overwhelmingly a force for the good?
Well, it's certainly true. They're substantially less used to leaks in Saudi Arabia and Moscow than they are in London and Washington, so they will have more difficulty in dealing with leaks. And it's also true that many of those governments say one thing in public and another in private, but that actually isn't necessarily untrue of our own government and governments elsewhere in the Western world. My problem, as I say, with the leaks in terms of non-democracy is not so much embarrassing them, that may do some good over time, is actually putting people at risk. And although you can exaggerate that, there are specific people, even if their names are not in there, people will be able to identify those people in those non-democracies, and those people run the risk of suffering very severe penalties.
But I think it's worth mentioning that we always hear this from people in power, is the cost of transparency, how dangerous it could be, even though it hasn't actually proven to be so. But there's a cost of secrecy, which we haven't talked about. And so just reading today's Guardian about the Russian stories, they talk about this 3 billion a year amount of bribery that goes on in one country, which can only be happening really in under the shroud of secrecy. So, I mean, secrecy causes corruption. That is, it's just so much more difficult to have corruption and abuse of power in an open system. So I think we need to also be shifting where we start the default argument on this.
Well, there's an awful lot more on this story at guardian.co.uk. But right now, we're going to move from troublemaking cables to troublemaking cable.
Off.
Because things are heating up for the Liberal Democrat business secretary who campaigned against raising university fees but is now legislating to increase them. And yes, Vince Cable now finds himself with the unhappy prospect of voting against his own proposal. Now, Jonathan, you've written a book just now about Machiavelli and how politicians might hold on to power. Do you think this would have been a fix too far even for the old prince?
I think it's a rather odd position to take that your department introduces a policy and not only is collective responsibility out the window, but you're not even going to support the policy of your own department and going to abstain on it. Also seems a strange way to be bold. If you're going to be bold, you'd vote against it if you disagree with it. Being in government and abstaining strikes me as the Liberals trying to be in opposition and government at the same time.
Well, they're trying to hold their party together, aren't they? That's the purpose of this unlikely fix, is that...
But united around a don't know, it doesn't seem a terribly sort of bold thing to do, that we're all united that we don't know what we think.
But in the coalition agreement, it allowed them to abstain, so the kind of idiocy is there from the beginning.
Yeah, why it's a strange thing. You've got, our system of government works on a basis of collective responsibility. If you don't agree with a policy, you resign. If you're going to have a government where the minister is introducing a policy and can't bring himself to vote for it, then why should anyone else support it?
But isn't our system of government based on, well, has evolved in response to loads of situations that are mostly not coalitions, and therefore these kind of weird opt-outs to collective responsibility are exactly the kind of thing that the rest of us need to get used to?
Well, I do think that we will, in all probability, face more coalition governments in the future. This big gap of parties in the middle is now so large, it's very hard to see how people will bridge them with an overall majority. Unless they really get a really huge swing at one election or another, but it's something that's crept up on us. So yes, we will have coalition governments. Yes, we will have the same practices as many other European governments in terms of coalition governments. But I think that our system does work because it's a particular sort of parliamentary system where the government in parliament is sovereign. It is a problem if you get rid of collective responsibility from that government. I'm not quite sure how you carry on making it work. Because once you move beyond the coalition agreement, then you're going to have all sorts of other issues where people might decide to abstain.
Heather, you've written a lot, obviously, about openness and getting things out on the public record, but this shows that openness on its own isn't enough, is it? The Liberal Democrats were very clear about what their position was before the election, and hey-ho, after the election, it's completely different.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, life moves on and people have to roll with changing circumstances. So, I mean, I take issue with this whole idea of collective responsibility in the first place. I wrote about this in my first book, Your Right to Know, because I just thought it's kind of immature of us to think that everybody in government has to by necessity think the same and agree the same. I would much prefer to see individual responsibility, and I think the public are perfectly capable of understanding that in a party, not everybody toes the party line. And in fact, I think they would prefer to see individual MPs standing up more for what they believe rather than having to be corralled into these sort of whipped positions.
The trouble is, they wouldn't get votes through Parliament.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to criticise our democracy for both being immature and over-mature. I mean, we got to be...
I don't think I've ever said it was over-mature.
But you're saying that... Well, I mean, the fact is our democracy has been there for quite a long time, and the way that it works is...
I wouldn't even say it's actually a democracy. I say it's a patina of democracy,
right,
on top of a feudal system.
A feudal system?
Yeah.
Right.
A system of patronage.
I don't quite know. If I go back to the point we were discussing, the way the system works is that people can vote parties in or out. The parties have a line. You either like it or you don't like it. If you have individuals running on their own tickets...
So
like in the American system, effectively, in America, people run as Republicans or Democrats, but actually are running on their own record. So if you're a Republican who voted against tax cuts, then you will be chucked out on that individual record. In this country, it would be very hard to make our system work like that because, as I say, it's a government based in Parliament. You'd have to have the sort of separation of powers you have in the United States to make that sort of system work effectively, I think.
I mean, I think, well, I would prefer to be voting for my MP, and I think maybe that's part of the issue, is people don't identify with political parties very much anymore, and they want to be voting for their MP as an individual. And there may be sets of ideologies that they share, but I don't think everybody's expecting them to on every single issue, vote the party line.
But how does a government get its business through the House, then?
Well, where they can make an agreement that they... that they can persuade all their MPs to it.
But Heather, what say you had a complexion of Parliament where the majority of them didn't actually agree on freedom of information being expanded, but some enlightened individuals did?
And that was in their party manifesto?
Yeah.
Do you mean? Well, if it was in their party manifesto, presumably they would have had to have had agreement, otherwise it wouldn't be in the manifesto. So, and if somehow it changed, I mean, this is what I'm wondering about with the cuts and with the student fees. If they had that in the manifesto in the beginning, what has now changed that parts of the party are fracturing off and they're not in agreement anymore? And I mean, I don't know what information's come into their spectrum.
Well, they say that,
but I'm imagining that it's they found out how much in debt this country is, and they've suddenly realised that the policy that they put in the manifesto is actually not economically sustainable.
Well, that's their argument.
That's their line, and they're sticking to it.
But isn't there a problem any government would have with just making the sums add up at all? If everyone followed their own conscience, they might say, I'll vote for more spending on this, a tax cut here, a free university education there. Because they all sound like jolly nice things. My conscience says they're a good thing, but do consciences make sums add up?
But that's why we have Parliament, because they're meant to be in there, that you have the executive who has the mandate, and if they've got the majority in the party, then most people you would think agree with that, so then it will still get passed. What I'm saying is it should be the case that not every single MP has to all the time agree with the party line. And I think if we're going to have a system like that, at the very least, then we need to start publishing the whip lines, because I think that would be really interesting for the public to know, is just how controlled their MP is. Because if they're thinking, well, really, what is the point of me having an MP? Why do we have all these MPs if they're actually just all voting the party line all the time? They're in fact a total, they're not really value for money.
Jonathan, what's your response to that?
I was just wondering where the evidence is that the people
you're just
really
attacked on so many fronts.
I just wanted to know
they like independent-minded MPs. We hear that again and again.
They always
Boris
say
Johnson,
that they like independent-minded
they can't
MPs.
Get
they like MPs who are a bit of fun, like Boris Johnson. But I see very little evidence they want to vote for their MPs. Most people don't know who their MPs are when they vote for them. The reason our system is developed in this way is they want to be able to vote for a party. And if you look at other parliamentary systems around the world, which are even less mature than our own, in Kuwait, for example, has an elected parliament. The parties are illegal there, so you can't run as a party. As a result, what you end up with is a parliament that is a sort of trade union, if you want, for the demands of the public service, because everyone works in the public service. So there is no way of making parliament responsible. If you don't have some sort of party that unites people together, it's very hard to see how you'd make a parliamentary system govern. You can in America, where you have an executive that's completely separate and elected with a separate democratic mandate. But in our country, that's not the way it works.
But is it really because that's what people want? You say it's evolved because people want to be able to vote for a party, or is it because politicians have found that the way that they can hang on to power is in fact by working in a strict
party? No, it developed in the 18th century because that was the way that the politicians could get things done, and they could be held accountable by the people. You can't hold politicians accountable if the party isn't responsible for, it doesn't set out a mandate and doesn't then deliver on that mandate.
Heather, do you think in an age of coalition politics where we're going to have these coalition documents overriding individual manifestos, we should get rid of manifestos? Get rid of these promises that get broken?
Well, I mean, a manifesto is a useful document, but certainly it's the document that you would think gets the party elected. If indeed, well, you know, and I think it's kind of unfortunate that we have the system that we do. I would like to see more individual people getting elected, you know, on their own merits rather than this political party that people no longer identify with. But if it's there, it's good to have. But equally, I would like to see that it moves on. So, you know, as you go into power, you have a coalition government and they put forward new policies. I mean, the policies are always changing.
One of the strange things is that an aspect of our insularity that no one seems to have looked at how coalition governments work in other countries. We're like the first people to ever discover a coalition government.
Right? We're on the moon.
Germany or Holland or anywhere else, there's the standard way that these things work. And it's funny, no one goes and looks at the German system, for example, where you have a coalition agreement that takes you so far. But as Heather says, you then face new challenges, new policies you have to make up, and how do you agree about those? They have a very complex system in Germany that deals with this. There's a pre-cabinet meeting every week held by the Chief of Staff and the Kanzleramt, who prepares for the cabinet meeting and works out the various coalition stresses and strains.
OK, we've overturned all the foundation stones of the Constitution, and even more radically now, Jonathan's suggesting that we should cast our eyes up from Westminster and look to the continent. Good God, it's time to stop. So many thanks to our guests, Jonathan Powell and Heather Brook. The producer was Phil Maynard.
I'm Legra Stratton, he was Tom Clark, and thank you very much for listening.
For more more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.